skies, temperatures 58 to 62. Winds from the south, 10 to 15. Sunny tomorrow with a slight chance of showers on the Iron Range and highs in the low 80s.
Hello, I'm Neil Kirksall.
And I'm Chris Howden. Coming up on As It Happens.
Jane Goodall was a young researcher. When she fell in love with chimpanzees in the wild, she ended up changing the way the world looked at those animals and their environment. Jane Goodall died today at the age of 91, and a friend tells us she was a pessimist with an endless capacity for hope.
And all's not fair. Yesterday, Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth targeted what he said were unfair promotions and unfairly unequal standards for women in the military. A retired Navy captain tells us she doesn't know what he's talking about.
Those stories and more coming up for you on the Wednesday edition of As It Happens.
There is more ahead from As It Happens here on People Powered KAXE. Support comes from Paul Bunyan Communications, powered by the Gigazone, a broadband cooperative featuring all fiber optic Gigazone internet speeds up to 10 gig and local customer service. Learn more at paulbunyan.net. Coming up in a few moments, we'll hear the set list with Malachi Coons, but right now let's sample our album of the week. It's called Neon Gray, Midnight Green, and it's by Nico Case, her eighth solo album and her first since 2018. And since that last album, many people who influenced Nico Case and her music unexpectedly passed away. Case wanted to dedicate the album to musicians and celebrate the organism that is people making music together. The song we're going to hear this evening from Nico Case is called Wreck.
Calm down, darling, don't take me to
This is The Set List on KAXE, where we highlight live music around the area for the upcoming week. I'm Malachi Coons. We are looking at four shows this Friday and Saturday, October 3rd and 4th, in Baxter, Duluth, and Bemidji. First up, Eli Gardner is playing Jack Pine Brewery in Baxter this Friday at 6 p.m. An Americana, gravelly-voiced singer-songwriter who blends folk, rock, and blues with stories of working class and everyday folks. His last album arrived in 2023, but he's released a handful of singles so far this year. Eli Gardner, this Friday, at Jack Pine Brewery in Baxter. On to Saturday for a pair of events in Duluth. 21st, Delilah Fest runs from 11 a.m. to 7 p.m. at Chester Bowl Park. Inspired by the Lilith Fair Festival of the 90s, the Lilith Fest features an all-women or non-male identifying lineup, including acclaimed folk singer Galen Lee, rising Americana duo The Penny Peaches, Jerry Small, and many more. 11 to 7 this Saturday in Duluth. Then, Canadian country and western singer Colter Wall is also playing at 7:30 at the Deck Symphony Hall. Known for his deep voice and Townes Van Zandt-inspired songwriting, Wall has been a leading figure in country music since the mid-teens and recently announced his latest album, Memories and Empties, due out in November. It's Colter Wall this Saturday at the Deck in Duluth. Finally, there is a punk and metal show late Saturday evening at Rail River Folk School in Bemidji. Four bands are on the lineup, including Bemidji group's Rotten Sardines playing punk and metal from Noxious Ghoul. Music begins at 9 p.m. at the Folk School, and the event is hosted by Sundown Records. The set list is made possible by the Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund.
Hello, I'm Neil Kirksall.
Good evening, I'm Chris Howden. This is As It Happens.
Primate soulmate, we remember Jane Goodall, who spent her life working to protect the home of the chimpanzees she helped the world fall in love with.
Pipeline in the pipeline. Alberta's premier revives the promise of a new oil corridor to the coast, and an industry leader says this time all the right players are aligned to make it happen.
Exercise in futility. A retired U.S. Navy captain says unequal fitness standards for men and women in combat roles don't exist, and she doesn't know why Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth doesn't know that.
The woman in the well. For years, the century-old remains of a woman found in a Saskatoon well went unidentified. Now police know who she was, thanks in part to some of her descendants who only just learned her story.
A sucker for a good sucker. A paleontologist says he experienced a perfect moment when he realized he was looking at an incredibly rare fossil of an incredibly old leech.
What could be more perfect? And hot button issue. Startling new research reveals the reason so many of us have any belly buttons, and the theory that our guts have their own gut instincts causes stomach upset in the world of science. As it happens, the Wednesday edition, radio that's well-versed in naval battles. Jane Goodall opened us up to a world within this one, a world we'd never seen before. Through her, we fell in love with Flo and her daughter Fifi. We were mesmerized by the gentleness of David Greybeard and his relationship with his best friend, Goliath. And through watching these chimpanzees in their natural environment, we developed a deeper appreciation for the natural world as a whole, one that Ms. Goodall worked tirelessly until the very end to protect. Jane Goodall died this morning while on a speaking tour in California. She was 91 years old. Just last week, as part of that tour, Ms. Goodall spoke with the Wall Street Journal about how she continued to have hope despite how bleak the world can sometimes seem.
Everybody, every day that we live, we make an impact on the planet, and we can choose what sort of impact we make. And people come to me depressed and saying, well, the world's a mess and, you know, there's nothing I can do about it. I'm just one person. And we have a saying, think globally, act locally. It's the wrong way around. If you think globally, you cannot but be depressed and feel helpless. But I say to them, think of your own community. What can you do there? What do you care about? Start doing something to make it better. Get other people to help you. You'll see you make a difference. That makes you feel good. Then you want to do more. Then you inspire more people.
Peter Biro is the chair emeritus of the Jane Goodall Institute Global and one of Jane Goodall's close friends. We reached him in Toronto.
Peter, that voice, that message, that passion, I mean, did anything rattle your friend's optimism and passion in all the years you knew her and worked with her?
Well, there's an important distinction that needs to be made, and she and I spoke about this often. In fact, every single time we met, including about 3 weeks ago when she was in Toronto. Yeah. And that is the distinction between being an optimist and being hopeful. She and I are both, in a sense, pessimists, but both extremely hopeful. And she helped me a lot to be hopeful. She believes strongly in the indomitable human spirit, the resilience, especially and the idealism of especially of young people. You know, what strikes me so much about that is her pragmatism. Mm-hmm. She was first and foremost interested in listening, not in preaching. And that business about local versus global is very much what she was all about. I mean, I can give you an example that is, if you want, I mean, I can give you an example.
Well, I do want examples, yeah. But I wanted to ask you about that meeting just 3 weeks ago. I mean, she was on this public speaking tour, as she often was, 91 years old, but clearly still working hard and passionate about her work. What did she say to you the last time you saw each other?
What I'll say about 3 weeks ago was that she was tired, but she was full of her usual piss and vinegar, and the fire in her belly was as bright as ever, and she was determined to keep going right until her last breath, which we most definitely did not anticipate was coming anytime soon.
Is this, from what you knew of her, I mean, if the time was going to come, whenever it was going to come, that this is how she wanted it to be?
Oh, absolutely. This would have been how she would have wanted to go. I would say that if there was a better way for her to go, it would have been to be in Gombe Reserve in Tanzania with her beloved chimps.
And in the beginning, you know, when she's in her 20s, she's going to Gombe, as you've mentioned, immersing herself. The way she's conducting her research, though, how she's documenting that research was really challenging how things were done, putting aside, you know, that time in the world and the fact that that she's a young woman doing this work fiercely. What did she tell you about what that time was like for her?
What she said about those early days was the same thing she's saying today about the planet. She didn't feel the fear that people would normally attribute to any young person finding themselves in the jungle. She, in a way, submitted to nature. She understood from the very, very beginning in those days. And there was a lot of discomfort lying, you know, on the ground, you know, in a tent.
Yeah.
With, by the way, her mother by her side in those early days.
Great encouragement from her to keep her going and to be fierce.
More than encouragement. Yeah, it was more than encouragement. It was fundamental belief. Yeah. It was trust in Jane's judgment. But, you know, Jane was always at peace with whatever her fate might be at any moment in her life, as long as she was living authentically and in a way that was kind of consistent with her basic instincts, which were generally very, very good.
They served her well, clearly. She became a household name as she did this work. You know, televised special followed her and things grew from there. But the chimps also became household names. Flo, David, Greybeard, Fifi, you know.
Of course.
What ultimately do you think? I mean, she was such a strong communicator, a clear communicator. But why do you think that people at that moment connected so deeply with these chimps and what she was studying?
The average person listening to her could relate because she was able to reach into our common, not just our common humanity, but our common nature as beings that were inescapably part of a much bigger story. And it's why, to her last breath, she was one of the most humble people I have ever known.
She is has been so inspiring to so many people, but women and young women in particular. And to your point just now, I don't think I've met anyone who has met Jane Goodall who did not just become completely enamored of her and her work. I know your granddaughter was with you at that appearance 3 weeks ago, and she's quite young, right? How was that for
her? My granddaughter's 7 years old. And, you know, I'll just tell you a funny story about that. I had spent a wonderful evening with her two nights before, and then she spoke at Meridian Hall, and my granddaughter said, "Grandpa, you promised me that I'd meet Jane Goodall." And I said, I did promise you, and you will meet her, I promise. But, you know, tonight, she's very, very busy. 2 minutes later, Susanna Name, who is Jane's traveling companion, called me, and she said, "Jane wants you to bring your granddaughter backstage to see her." And I said, no, we don't want to disturb her right now. Other people need to spend time with her. And she said, "No, she insists, bring her back right now." And so we did. And it was just a moment that Akiva, my granddaughter, will remember for the rest of her life. But that was Jane. And now, of course, in the wake of her passing this morning, part of me is wondering whether Jane knew something that I didn't know. One thing I know for sure is that Jane was happy when she passed today.
Peter, I'm so glad we could speak. Thank you. And I'm glad your granddaughter got to meet her as well. I hope she's doing okay with this news when she learns.
Well, she doesn't yet know about it, but when she finds out this evening, she will be very upset.
You take care, Peter. I know this isn't easy for you either, so thank you.
Well, thank you, and it was a privilege to talk about my friend Jane with you. Thank you.
Peter Bureau is the Chair Emeritus of the Jane Goodall Institute Global. We reached him in Toronto. Conservationist and groundbreaking primatologist Jane Goodall died this morning. She was 91 years old. There was a lot of grumbling before the speech, and it seems like that grumbling is louder today. As we talked about on yesterday's show, Pete Hegseth, the secretary of the newly rebranded U.S. Department of War, called hundreds of military leaders to Marine Corps Base Quantico to listen to a speech. He said, "As history teaches us, the only people who actually deserve peace are those who are willing to wage war to defend it." He declared the end of the woke department. He slammed fat troops, tightened grooming standards, and said there would be an end to promotions based on what he referred to as the wrong reasons: race, gender quotas, and historic so-called firsts. He also said this:
"Today, at my direction, each service will ensure that every requirement for every combat MOS, for every designated combat arms position, returns to the highest male standard only. This is not about preventing women from serving. We very much value the impact of female troops. Our female officers and NCOs are the absolute best in the world. But when it comes to any job that requires physical power to perform in combat, those physical standards must be high and gender neutral. If women can make it, excellent. If not, it is what it is. If that means no women qualify for some combat jobs, so be it. That is not the intent, but it could be the result. So be it. It will also mean that weak men won't qualify because we're not playing games."
Many are pushing back against Secretary Hegseth's remarks, including female veterans. Lori Manning is a retired Navy captain who has since worked as an advocate for women in the military. We reached her in Alexandria, Virginia.
Lori Manning, you've heard those words a couple of times now, at least I'm sure. How do they sit with you?
Well, they sit with me along this line. He says he's putting this into effect today. Those standards have, in fact, been in effect since 1994, when the U.S. first started sending women into combat aboard aircraft and ships. It's nothing new. It's been in effect for 34 years. I don't know why he doesn't know that.
Why do you think he's saying it now and in that way?
That's the question, isn't it? I think he has his mind on what they call the Army fitness test, which is not an occupational standard. It's something that everybody in the Army has to do, including 70-year-old, say, Catholic chaplains. That has traditionally been normed by both age and gender. But This past spring, the Army changed that. It took that test and made two different tiers of it. One of the tiers is for all those who are in combat arms occupations, and they now all have to meet the exact same standard, male or female. So what he was ordering the Army to do happened earlier. It's been in effect since July.
Is there any disagreement from those you know who are still serving and your former colleagues that these grueling combat roles are and should be gender neutral?
No. Everybody agrees with that. We think that, and everybody I know, men and women, think that the standards for any military occupation need to be and must be gender neutral.
You served for a long time, the 70s, the 80s, the 90s. You commanded large units, including both men and women. What was it like for you? What kind of change did you see over those decades?
Well, the two most amazing things I saw was, one, the U.S. opening of the service academies at West Point, Annapolis, Air Force Academy to women. The second was the opening of combat aviation and naval combat to women. Of course, the Canadians were way ahead of us on that, but we finally did it in the early 90s. And there was, at the time, there was there were people who just didn't like it. But now that we've been doing it for 30 years, it seems like the norm. It seems normal to just about anybody. And I never hear anybody saying women should come off ships or out of aircraft anymore. So ground combat is something that, again, these women will all meet the same standard as men. And as time goes by, people will get used to it.
What kinds of barriers did you face in those early years?
The first barrier is, why did you even want to join the Navy? The guy I went to the junior proms with, his mother asked me, why would you do that? And I did it because I felt patriotic. I wanted to travel. I knew I would get really good training there. And I saw during the time I was in the Navy, the women get permission to do more and more and more jobs. And it was done very slowly, very carefully, and it always worked. Nothing ever went wrong, despite what people had predicted, right up through the opening of all the Navy ships and submarines to women. It works because women can do these jobs. Yeah. Not every woman can be in ground combat. Yeah. And so far, the Navy has had no women SEALs, which says to me that these standards are being enforced. That's a very rugged test. And so far, no women have passed it. And no one has put a quota on it saying, well, you have to take at least two of these.
So given what you've experienced and the changes you've seen, hearing a speech from Hegseth like that, from the Secretary of Defense, does it feel like a step backwards?
No, it feels like a here we go again. Mm-hmm. Here we go again. People have fought the opening of new occupations to women for the past 50 years. I think some of them in the civilian life. But it does tell me that the Secretary of Defense does not understand the basic laws that have been in effect for 30-some years, saying women have to meet the same standard as men. How could he not know that?
You said, yeah, I think you told the Associated Press, it suggests that somehow there's some sort of cheating going on, or that people are getting, you know, special treatment.
I think he believes that women are getting special treatment, that maybe they're getting through ranger training by a nod and a wink or something. It's not the case. But I've also read his book, The War on Warriors. And I think he's got very strong personal convictions that women should be nurturers, they give life, and men should be protecting them, that they shouldn't be in combat. I think that's a personal sense of his. I'm sure he's very sincere about it. But it doesn't keep women from getting killed in combat, including an awful lot of civilian women. I think it's best if we let women be able to defend themselves.
Our listeners heard last night we were speaking to a retired lieutenant general assessing that meeting before all those military leaders, and we played a bit of what he said about what is and is not toxic in his view. He also said his department was going to undertake a full review of the, quote, definitions of so-called toxic leadership, bullying, and hazing to empower leaders to enforce standards without fear of retribution or second-guessing, unquote. What does that mean to you?
That means he better be awfully, awfully careful about where he draws the line between toxic behavior and hazing and crime. He better know where to draw the line between a tough boss and somebody who was committing a crime.
Lori Manning, I appreciate your time. Thank you for this.
Oh, you're welcome. Good talking with you.
Likewise.
That's retired Navy Captain Lori Manning in Alexandria, Virginia. Nature is full of miracles, but some of those miracles are disgusting. So I acknowledge that leeches are amazing because they secrete a peptide that prevents blood from coagulating or whatever. But if I see one, I will burst into tears, and they will not be tears of wonderment. Fortunately for science, researchers in Waukesha County, Wisconsin, feel very differently. They're digging into the history of leeches in their area, which looked a lot different 437 million years ago, didn't we all? It was a tropical coastline filled with some of the oldest known jawless vertebrates. And today, in a paper published in the journal PeerJ, scientists say the discovery pushes the origin of leeches back by at least 200 million years. Carmen Nanglu is a paleontologist at the University of California, Riverside, and a co-author of the study. We reached him in Riverside, California.
Karma, I'd wager that a lot of people don't like the fact that leeches exist at all, but you and your colleagues are excited to have done this research and learned that they've probably been around a lot longer than we've thought. Why is that exciting to you?
Yeah, it's exciting for a number of reasons. And yeah, that makes total sense. A lot of people are not most stoked about leeches. Probably their first experience is maybe, you know, going to the cottage and going for a swim. And, you know, it's not a pleasant thing to come out of the water with a leech on you. But they are a really, you know, unique component of the diversity of animal life on this planet, a really successful group of organisms that we know has been around for a long time. And actually, our study suggests they've been around for even longer. And so I think a big part of what makes the study so interesting is, yeah, that component, getting an actual fossil of a leech, which we'd never had a leech body fossil before, only the fossilized cocoons.
And why are they so hard to preserve? Why is that the reality, that you've never had a fossil to work with?
Yeah, I mean, they're the exact kind of animal that does not lend itself to fossilization. Mm-hmm. So most animals that become fossils are relatively big. That helps with, you know, fossilizing. There's more material to actually potentially fossilize. And if you are an animal that has hard components of the body, things like teeth or bones, you know, everyone thinks of dinosaurs immediately. That also helps fossilizing. Leeches are basically the exact opposite, where they almost have no hard tissues at all. It's all soft tissue material. And that's a big part of what makes them so rare and this find so unique.
Rare, but not impossible. So you're reading the scientific paper about fossils, you know, in Wisconsin, and you spotted something that certainly piqued your interest. What did you see?
And so this actually dates back to 2020. So around the time of COVID, we were all stuck in our houses, basically. We weren't able to go to the field, go to the lab. And a number of researchers from Ohio State University primarily published this paper on a site from Wisconsin. It's about 437-ish million years old. And among the fossils they described there was a huge diversity of these very enigmatic worms. So I reached out to a few of my colleagues who specialize on leeches, saying, you know, does any of this seem like they actually could be fossilized leeches, given how rare they must be based on their anatomy? They provided us with a bunch of photos. Again, we were all stuck at home at the time. No one could make it to the museum collections. And they sent us a bunch of photos. And after, you know, checking out dozens of them, there was one specimen in particular where we were like, okay, this has got to be a leech.
And in that moment, are you losing it with excitement? You know, while the rest of us are baking bread or binge watching shows, you're looking at this picture and are you just, you know, that this is game changing?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, to be clear, we were doing all that stuff too. We were also stuck at home bouncing off the walls. But yes, absolutely. It was a nice change of pace of the day. It's the exact kind of singular, exciting moment you hope for when you're doing research on invertebrate life or evolutionary biology, paleontology. It's the perfect moment.
Take us through what you saw that suggested to you that this for sure had to be a leech fossil.
Yeah, there's really two primary things. The first one and the most obvious thing is the caudal sucker. So if you imagine a modern day leech, they stick to you, right? And so they usually have this large sucker, which they use like, you know, like a suction cup to hold on to either you when they're feeding or part of the benthos, the sort of marine ground, or, you know, to crawl around. So this fossil, which we called Macromyzon, which means big sucker, is, you know, a beautiful example where we have that unique structure preserved really well.
Yeah.
The second thing are the segments of the body. So, you know, lots of animals have suckers, lots of animals have these kinds of segments. But to my knowledge, no others have this exact combination of the two.
Mm-hmm.
So it's really the confluence, having both of them together preserved in the same body, is what gives us the confidence to say that this is a leech in the fossil record.
You don't think that this particular leech fits into what we think of, you know, leeches as bloodsuckers?
No, not this particular leech. So we think of leeches primarily as bloodsuckers, but there's a huge diversity of different feeding strategies that even the modern leeches can have. For this fossil in particular, when we look at the environment it lived in, which was marine, and we look at the co-occurring species, we don't have animals that would have vertebrate blood to feed on. And so what we've suggested that we think it was probably the kind of animal that engulfed whole invertebrates and ate them, digested them slowly, or would have been feeding on the internal fluids of invertebrates, so not a blood feeder.
Right, but so much, it's still scary, even maybe even more terrifying in that description.
Well, if you're the kind of animal that was smaller than this kind of creature and then ran across it, it would absolutely still be terrifying. Just because it's not a blood feeder and we don't have to be worried doesn't mean other animals in the ecosystem don't have to be worried.
Noted. Just to be clear, how was this preserved when it's usually so unlikely and so rare?
Yeah, with this kind of exceptional preservation, it usually has to do with things like the body being relatively rapidly buried. So that helps limit the activity of animals that might scavenge on the corpse that would, you know, stop it from being fossilized. It limits bacterial activity, factors like that, which help stabilize the body and then turn into a fossil rather than being decayed away or eaten by scavengers.
You've learned a lot already, but there's more to answer, I'm sure. So what are you curious to answer next and discover?
Within the Waukesha site where Macromyzon comes from, there's tons of different worms from this site that have enigmatic evolutionary histories. So number one is, now that things are opened up again, unlike the start of this project, we can go back and take a look at some of these other fossils, see what they are. And then from the perspective of leeches, just trying to understand how they fit into the broader evolutionary story of diversification about 437 million years ago. This fossil is just the beginning of the story.
Great to speak with you, Karma. Thank you.
Thank you for your interest.
Karma Nanglu is a paleontologist at the University of California, Riverside, and that's where we reached him. Last week on As It Happens, we kicked off the fiercest competition of the year, Fat Bear Week, at Katmai National Park and Preserve in Alaska. The annual head-to-head and bod-to-bod event in which the public votes to decide which brown bear has bulked up best for winter. And there were some chonkers, including reigning champ 128 Grazer and the aptly named 32 Chunk. Ranger Ashley Monaco told us about him.
Surprisingly, he is looking great. And I only say that because I think it was back in June, he showed up to the river. Well, he showed up to the river and then disappeared for a little bit and then came back to the river. And people noticed he had a significant jaw injury. And we don't know exactly what that injury is, but it does look like a partially broken jaw. Mm. He has like a back tooth sticking out. When Chunk arrived with that injury, we weren't sure how it was going to go. And he seems to have adapted well. He's fishing successfully. He's eating. He's definitely packed on the weight.
Despite that injury, Chunk has beat out his 11 bear competitors and been crowned the winner of Fat Bear Week 2025. He received 30,000 more votes than his competitor in the final, Bear 856.
Congratulations to everyone involved. We're going to take a short break now. When we return, an Alberta woman tells us she could hardly believe it when Toronto police called her about a murder committed more than a century ago in which her great-grandmother was the victim.
And Alberta proposes a proposal for a pipeline. A WNBA star blasts the league's commissioner, and we dig in to belly buttons. Not literally. Stay tuned. I'm Chris Howden.
And I'm Neil Kirksall.
You are listening to As It Happens here on People Powered KAXE. Good evening, I'm Jennifer Barr. At 7 o'clock on the river, it's a great mix of music. Your volunteer host this evening is Katie Carter. And at 10 o'clock, it's more great music on Headwaters with Kari Headland. Support comes from Rapids Brewing Company, a place for gathering and community, featuring live music multiple times a week, farm fresh food, and rotating beers from their own brew house. More information about their events, music, and menu at rapidsbrewingco.com. Since 1976, federal funding has helped keep KAXE on the air, and today, for the first time, we continue on without it. We are here because of you, and we'll keep going because of you. Peopled Power Radio is not going away. You can join us at KAXE.org. Weather tonight, slight chance of showers and thunderstorms after 2 a.m., cloudy, temperatures 58 to 62.
Alberta's premier says she has a plan to build a pipeline, or a plan for a plan to build a pipeline, and she's not waiting for industry or the federal government to take the lead. Danielle Smith announced that the province will head up a group of companies and Indigenous participants to push forward an application for a pipeline from Alberta to the northwest coast of British Columbia. The application plans to take advantage of Prime Minister Mark Carney's promise to build major projects of national significance. Alex Pourbaix is the executive chair of Cenovus Energy and part of a supervisory panel for the pipeline application. We reached him in Calgary.
Alex, you know as well as anyone that this kind of a plan, this kind of a project, to say that it has been a fraught process over the years is certainly an understatement. What makes you think this time this plan is different?
You know, my observation would be that anti-pipeline sentiment probably peaked, I don't know, 10 or 12 years ago. And I think at the time there was a view that oil and gas were really at the end of the horizon, that you know, in a very short number of years, oil and gas, reliance on oil and gas would be replaced with renewables, battery technology. I think experience in those intervening years has really shown that oil and gas are incredibly important to every economy. And, you know, the polling that I have seen over the last number of years shows that Canadians have really begun to appreciate that oil and gas is going to be with us for a very long time. Canada is the best, the most environmentally stringent producer of oil and gas in the world. We're a great place to invest. And if the world is going to be consuming oil and gas, it should be Canada's oil and gas.
So you think there's a shift in public sentiment is what I'm hearing you saying. There is concern already, just even immediately after this announcement, as you might imagine or might have prepared for. BC's Premier, David Eby, has already spoken out. We'll play a little bit for you in our audience.
The problem that we have is that Premier Smith continues to advance a project that is entirely taxpayer-funded, has no private sector proponent, is not a real project, and is incredibly alarming to British Columbians, including First Nations along the coast, whose support is required for the success of the billions of dollars in real projects that I'm talking about. We need a major projects office at the federal level, not a major distractions office, not a major politics office, but an office that advances real shovel-ready projects that will move this economy forward in British Columbia and nationally. And what I am seeing from Alberta directly threatens that.
If, Alex, the province that this pipeline will need to go through is already slamming it, the premier of that province, what chances are there of this succeeding?
I would take exception to a couple of comments the premier made. And our premier in the press conference today was very, very clear that the Alberta government's role is very much at the front end of this to help industry get a new package of regulation for this project that would make it feasible for industry to go forward. And she was very, very clear that at the end of the day, the lion's share of the capital for this project would be coming from the private sector. Mm-hmm. The other observation I would have about Premier Eby's comments is that this project will never go without the support of and involvement as likely as equity owners of the involved BC Indigenous mm-hmm. communities along the route. And this is, you know, I think people need to understand that right now the Canadian economy is really in a very tough situation. We have very few industries that can ramp up and really materially impact GDP in the relatively short term. Now, the energy sector is an industry that can do that. So I would definitely not agree with the view that this was a vapor kind of project.
Does Premier Eby's response, though, suggest to you that the necessary bridge building about this before the Premier Smith's announcement today, that maybe that relationship building did not happen? Does that concern you at this stage?
You know, that's really above my pay grade. I know because the premier said that she did have a discussion with the premier on Monday before this was announced, and I think she stated in the Q&A that there's obviously more work to do, but she's very willing to do that. And she was very, very clear about engagement with Indigenous communities along the route and the necessity and the wisdom of doing that and making sure that they are very materially consulted, but also partners in this ultimately.
One of the other issues, as you well know, our colleagues were reporting earlier this month as that potential list of what the Prime Minister has called nation-building projects was being discussed, that no major company has shown an interest in or in applying to build a pipeline. Do you think what we heard today is going to change that? Do you know that the companies are going to suddenly start lining up for this?
I think the reason you haven't seen pipeline companies lining up to put in an application to build a pipeline is that the regulatory environment we find ourselves in is demonstrated by what happened with Northern Gateway, with Energy East, with the Petronas LNG project. It has become almost untenable to go forward with any sense of understanding of what the rules are in order to meet the test to get that permit and that approval. And that, as I said, I mean, that is entirely related to the regulatory and political environment we find ourselves operating in. And it is not at all related to the fundamental attractiveness of the business or the investability of the business, absent right now this huge challenge with respect to the permitting environment.
Alex, thank you for this.
No problem. It was nice talking to you, Neil.
Take care.
Alex Pourbaix is the executive chair of Cenovus Energy and is part of a supervisory panel for a future pipeline application. He's in Calgary. Nafisa Collier's Minnesota Lynx may be out of the WNBA playoffs, but she is just warming up. In the last seconds of one of their final games, Ms. Collier went down hard during a steal by the Phoenix Mercury's Alyssa Thomas. No foul was called, and there was immediate outrage. Lynx coach Cheryl Reeve had to be dragged off the court, after which she received a game suspension and a record $15,000 fine, which meant that for their must-win semifinal game, the Lynx were missing both their star player and their coach. They lost. But during Nafisa Collier's end-of-season press conference, she didn't want to talk about the loss. She wanted to talk about what she and other players see as an unwillingness by WNBA Commissioner Kathy Engelbert to protect players and to pay them what they're worth as they head into a highly contentious collective bargaining.
At Unrivaled this past February, I sat across from Kathy and asked how she planned to address the officiating issues in our league. Her response was, "Well, only the losers complain about the refs." I also asked how she planned to fix the fact that players like Caitlin, Angel, and Paige, who are clearly driving massive revenue for the league, are making so little for their first 4 years. Her response was, "Caitlin should be grateful she makes $16 million off the court, because without the platform that the WNBA gives her, she wouldn't make anything." And in that same conversation, she told me, "Players should be on their knees thanking their lucky stars for the media rights deal that I got them." That's a mentality driving our league from the top. We go to battle every day to protect a shield that doesn't value us. The league believes it succeeds despite its players, not because of them. This year alone, I've gotten calls, texts, and well wishes from so many players across the league. Those moments remind me that sometimes there are things bigger than the results than this game we play. But do you know who I haven't heard from? Kathy. Not one call, not one text. Instead, the only outreach has come from her number two telling my agent that she doesn't believe physical play is contributing to injuries. That is infuriating, and it's the perfect example of the tone-deaf, dismissive approach that our leaders always seem to take. Our leadership's answer to being held accountable is to suppress everyone's voices by handing out fines. I'm not concerned about a fine. I'm concerned about the future of our sport. At some point, everyone deserves to hear the truth from someone who I hope has earned the benefit of the doubt to fight for what is right and fair for our athletes and our fans. We have the best players in the world. We have the best fans in the world. But right now, we have the worst leadership in the world. If I didn't know exactly what the job entailed, maybe I wouldn't feel this way. But unfortunately for them, I do.
At what point between, you know, the end of the season and today did you decide that, like, that was how you wanted to open this and, you know, you wanted to prepare something like that?
I think, obviously, like, this is something that we've been talking about for a really long time. But I think just seeing, like, the response as well, just hearing over and over and over again, we have the best refs in the world, we don't have a problem, you know, none of the injuries are due to physicality in the way that we're reffing, it's an insult to my intelligence, honestly. I've played this game for my entire life, and you think that I don't know what it looks like when it's played the way it's supposed to be played. And whether the league believes it has a problem or not, just even acknowledging it to the players would be a step in the right direction. There is clearly a problem. People across the board, coaches, players, winning, losing, fans, everyone can see that there's a problem. Accepting that is the first stage.
That was Minnesota Lynx forward and Unrivaled founder Nafisa Collier speaking at her WNBA end-of-season press conference. In a statement, WNBA Commissioner Kathy Engelbert said she was disheartened by how Ms. Collier characterized their conversation, but that she was committed to ensuring a bright future for the players and the league. Until now, she was only known as the woman in the well. Her remains were found in a well shaft in the Sutherland neighborhood of Saskatoon in 2006. Investigators now believe she was killed sometime between 1916 and 1918. And this week, after almost two decades, police have publicly confirmed her name, Alice Spence, born Alice Burke. To come to that conclusion, Saskatoon police worked with members of the Toronto Police Service's investigative genetic genealogy team. And in the process of their investigation, they called up Cindy Camp. We reached Ms. Camp in Sherwood Park, Alberta.
Cindy, back in July, your family starts getting these calls from Toronto police. What were they saying?
Well, we were at our lake on holidays, and my daughter just said, "Mom, there's all these calls from Toronto, and I don't know who they are." And then she said, "Oh, but there's a voicemail." So we listened to the voicemail, And it was Jennifer Ford calling from the Toronto Police, one of the genealogists. So Lisa and I both looked at each other and thought, what were you doing with the Toronto Police?
Lisa's your daughter?
And Lisa's my younger daughter, mm-hmm. yes. My older daughter is Sarah. And so we called Jennifer back, and she started telling us the story about the woman in the well in Sutherland, Saskatchewan. And I recognized the name because I have Alice's name in my family tree, but I didn't know anything about mm-hmm. Alice's history.
They thought that there might be a familial connection, right? What were they specifically yes. asking you for?
They wanted us to do a DNA sample so that they could check that we were indeed her relatives. They had, they didn't even have a name when they started working on this case. And then Sergeant Funk from the Saskatoon Police went to Ottawa for a conference and listened to one of the genealogists there, and he ended up sending her all the information that they had, and within about a week or so, they had a name. So then once they had a name, then they're searching on Ancestry for Alice and came across our family.
How long ultimately did it take to get the test that you did back to confirm whether you were connected?
It was about 4 weeks, I think.
Were you able to think about anything else during that time, or were you able to, you know, sort of compartmentalize it?
Luckily, we had a holiday booked.
Okay.
we were away for 2 weeks, so that helped pass the time. But then it was every day I'm checking my email to see if the results are back yet.
And so you had an inkling about this relative, but not a lot of detail. Was there anyone in your family that you could call to help fill in those blanks?
No. And my grandmother never talked about her family. Mm. This we surmised this would have happened when she was 12. Mm. And then her dad died when she was 17. So I don't really know much about her before her marriage to my grandfather. But that was 1925.
So all of this shock would be an appropriate word then?
Yes. And I called, my dad had a sister who unfortunately had passed away as well, but I called her daughter and said, do you know anything about this? And she hadn't heard anything about it either.
So many people, so many jurisdictions, so much investigation and testing that had to happen. Yeah. Ultimately, yeah. What have police now been able to tell you about Alice Spence, how she died, and who might have been responsible for her death?
She was murdered. Her left arm was cut off, and she was placed in this barrel. And then the barrel was dropped down the well. They have a suspicion who did it, but they can't prove anything at this point in time. So as far as the Saskatoon police are concerned, the case is closed.
This is quite remarkable to hear as someone who is not a member of your family. How are you, your daughters, your granddaughter, taking all of this in and dealing with this now?
I thought I was doing okay until Monday when we had the press conference, mm-hmm. and then sort of the emotion of it all really hit me. And the Sergeant Funk from the Saskatoon Police took us out to the graveyard where she was buried.
So she had been buried, but the grave was not marked. They didn't know who she was. So now to be able to not only visit it, but to get to the place where you can have a properly marked grave, an acknowledgement of who she was and the life she lived. How is that sitting with you now?
Well, the first thing I said to my girls, I said, if she is, you know, my great-grandmother, the first thing I want to do is get a headstone for her if she doesn't have one. And she doesn't. There's nothing there. The cemetery had put a little marker there for us on Monday. But struggling with what to put on it because we don't know for sure her year of birth, or it's a guess as to her year of death. So we decided not to put dates on it. But mm-hmm. just trying to find something appropriate to put on the headstone.
It's a powerful thing whenever we get a chance to find out more about our own personal history and our lineage and our families. What kind of, it's so complicated, this story. There's the surprise of getting that call, the horrific nature, how she died and how her body was left there.
Yes.
So what has it told you or taught you about your family?
As I age, my goal is to spend as much time with my family as I can. And just make sure that the stories are told so that they carry on for the future generations.
Cindy, I'm very glad we could speak. Thank you.
Well, thank you.
Take care.
It's been a pleasure.
Thank you.
Cindy Camp is the great-granddaughter of the late Alice Spence. We reached her in Sherwood Park, Alberta. Jimi Hendrix with his best-known song, Belly Button Window. Speaking of which, welcome to the latest edition of our best-known recurring news segment, Belly Button Window. We have never fully understood our belly buttons, specifically so-called innies, short for inexplicables, which apparently make up 90% of belly buttons. We need answers, but science has been absent, emphasis on abs. But now, unexpectedly, it has made a discovery that's extremely absorbing, emphasis on abs. Researchers from the Institute of Science Tokyo were trying to improve techniques for hernia surgery. And during their research, they discovered a whole new body part, a fibrous tunnel-like structure, in the words of lead author Satoru Muro. And if you were tiny and you followed that tunnel, you would find that it was attached to the connective tissue in the abdominal wall that holds our organs in place. And if you do that, you should wear some kind of tiny miner's helmet with a headlamp in it, or take a tiny flashlight, you know, just if you wind up tiny somehow. Now, strangely, this fibrous tunnel-like structure has gone unremarked upon forever. Now the Japanese researchers have not only remarked upon it, they have named upon it, calling it the umbilical sheath. They say the connective tissue kind of gently pulls back on the sheath, creating a concavity, hence innies. They have not yet researched outies, short for outside the realm of our understanding, but they have already filled a gap in the anatomical record that was absolutely absurd. Emphasis on abs. And abs. Here are Darling DeMays with Stomach Ghost.
Things weren't as good, reason to fight. We were running. You've been listening to As It Happens from CBC, heard across the United States on public radio.
You can also find As It Happens wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Chris Howden. Thanks for listening.
And I'm Neil Kirksall. Goodbye.